This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health. And I'd like to drill down on this concept of functional health. And it has declined over the past decade, largely due to deteriorating emotional health and the increasing prevalence of pain. And this according to a report from Stats Canada, which also says that the percentage of Canadians who think they are either in perfect health or very good health dropped from just under 70% 10 years ago to 56% last year, or in 2024, sorry. And there's a demographic aspect with the best news for older Canadians. So middle-aged people, 65 and under, well, their functional health stayed the same. People over 75, well, their functional health improved, but the sharpest decline was among young people aged 18 to 34. So my question is, how much of this is a matter of perception? Was the pandemic a factor? Because we know it really affected especially young people's mental health. What else could have played into this? So the numbers to call, 866-740-4740. That's the text line and the long distance phone line. The local phone line, 416-360-0740.
Now time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Malcolm Moore, who is a medical oncologist with the Princess Margaret Cancer Center, former head of BC Cancer, Dr. Fahad Razak, a general internist at St. Michael's Hospital and the Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the University of Toronto, and Dr. Elisa Naiman, a family doctor practicing in Toronto. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Libby.
Hi there.
I would like to start with Fahad on this concept of functional health and how much of it is a question of perception and how much of it is really something you can measure.
I think it's something that has a mixture of more objective measures and more subjective. So it's made out of 8 components. It includes things like an objective effect on vision, hearing, but then it moves on towards things which are more perception-based, things like your emotional health, how much pain you feel, and they put it all together in an index. And from a purely research science point of view, a lot of scientists have problems with very different concepts being lumped together in one index like this. The reason why is that the headline from this report is big loss in functional health for Canadians. That sounds dramatic. When you look under the hood, you see that most of the objective measures have actually not changed, but things like emotional health have changed. Now, let me quickly say emotional health is very important. I just don't think it should be lumped together in this composite that is very hard to understand. And then when you look at emotional health, the age group most affected, young people, the time frame in which they were affected, the pandemic and post-pandemic period, to me, it makes a lot of sense. We know that this finding would be related to a lot of other things we've seen, a rise in certain kinds of substance use, depression rates, et cetera, that have occurred during this period. And it was a period of great job instability, social isolation, a lot of factors that drive things like emotional distress. So I think the finding is consistent with what we know, but that headline about functional health in general declining, I think, is a little bit misleading.
Okay. Elisa, what do you find in your practice? And do you see this divide where your older patients maybe feel like they're doing better than they did a few years ago, but the opposite among your younger patients?
I agree with that. So what I think happened was maybe it was the pandemic, and maybe we've moved on since then, and younger people are definitely having a harder time, and the stress that people describe, it's not like the stress that people even described 10 or 15 years ago or 20 when I first started practicing. People have complex lives. There's a lot of financial stressors now. There's a breakdown in community. People don't socialize with people, and definitely people will come in and you can tell that people have ongoing mental health burden or emotional distress that just didn't exist before. I think at the opposite end of one's life, that my older patients, they seem to be a little bit more financially stable. There are some patients who do live paycheck to paycheck and do struggle being on fixed income. But in general, the overall thing is that as people have aged, in my older demographic patients, they seem to be doing well. They travel, they socialize with people, they're generally in good health, and they don't seem to have the same stressors that younger people have. Younger people come in, nobody expects to own a house in Toronto anymore. And people are having a hard time finding a job. People are having a hard time in relationships and finding people to date. And when they meet people, they often find it quite frustrating in that it's hard to date in this time. So I definitely think that there has been an increase in people's emotional distress and the burden that it places on people that didn't exist before.
Okay. You know, it's been known for a long time, Malcolm, what they call like this U-shaped curve of happiness, where in general, people tend to be happier as they're older, which is something that might be a little counterintuitive. But the other thing that comes out of these numbers is that men are a lot more vulnerable to this emotional distress and depression and all of that.
Well, so Libby, you and I are well into our Zoomer years,
yes.
So I think we probably look at this data the same. And the first thing that struck me when I looked at this was, to what degree is this perception rather than reality? Because this is not really a measure of health. I mean, measures of health are things like heart attack rates, cancer rates, survival rates. This is a measure of how people feel about their health. And I do think that I don't want to minimize the distress of younger people because they're considerable. But, you know, when I think back to my parents who grew up in England during the war, they were dealing with things like, would their house get bombed? In that days, it was like you suck it up and you get on with it. And, you know, even when I trained, you know, we used to be on call one night in three when I was training. When I ran the CCU, I'd start at 8 o'clock on Tuesday and I wouldn't leave till 5 o'clock on Wednesday. And that was just the way it was. And we didn't have wellness committees and we didn't worry about that. It was just you suck it up and you do it. So I think you'd have to, as Fahad said, this is a conglomerate of things, some that are objective, some that are very subjective. And I think there's a big element of perception here. The other point I'd make is that it is true that maybe as you get older, you get happier, you get more settled. But the reality is that a lot of physical symptoms, and you and I, Libby, can account for this, are considerably worse as you're older than you are when you're younger. Like, when I look back to the way my health was in my 30s, and I would say it was incredible. Like, you know, I physically didn't have pain. I could do things. So I think, you know, the way you see things depends where you sit. So I think I would be, as Fahad was, I'd be skeptical of this and whether there's been actual changes in health over the last 5 or 10 years, putting the pandemic aside. I'm less convinced of that.
Okay. I have another question I want to start with you, Malcolm, and it's about your old stomping ground, BC. So starting with Princess Margaret, we've covered Princess Margaret being on the forefront of trying to recruit unhappy Americans, $50 million to try to get early stage researchers. So yesterday we just had an announcement from BC where after a very expensive ad campaign, they have recruited 400 American frontline healthcare workers. And I'm wondering your view of that. Are they doing something that maybe we should emulate? I'm also wondering, you know, they David Eby said that dissatisfaction with Donald Trump was a factor. And, you know, presumably they're recruiting people from Washington State, where more people would tend to have progressive views and dislike Trump more. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, I think it's good. I mean, I think we've talked about this on the show. It troubles me when we recruit physicians and frontline healthcare workers from developing countries where they're desperately needed. I think the U.S. is an enormous pool of healthcare workers that are, for the large part, extremely well-trained and capable. And so I think if we are able to recruit from the, it's always been hard to recruit from the U.S., to be honest. And it's not that easy to recruit to BC because it's a fabulous place, but the cost of living, particularly if you're in the big centers, is high. So I think it's, you know, like the longer term solution is to expand our training programs, our medical schools, our nursing schools, et cetera. And that's what is happening. But we're not going to see the benefits of that for 5 to 10 years at the earliest. So I think in the meantime, you have to do something. And I think whatever strategies they're using in BC to recruit Americans, I think is certainly something we should look at as well.
Fahad, I mean, according to this, and I forget how much money they spent on the ad campaign. It was in the millions. But the province, BC, received nearly 2,800 applications during the first 10 months of the campaign. A lot of them are still being processed. But again, you know, should we just, you know, copy what they're doing?
Yeah, look, like Malcolm, I have no compunction about drawing in healthcare workers from the United States. There's a lot we can offer them here. I know we spend a lot of time on your show talking about things that should improve in Canada. We've talked about them, science funding, health, you know, all kinds of things. There's a lot of good about this country and people wanting to come and work here who believe in our system of healthcare provision, of our government, of our political positions, whatever. I say wonderful. And look, BC spent $40 billion on healthcare last year. A few million to recruit in healthcare workers, I don't think is really shifting the needle in terms of their total spending. And if it brings in a significant number of effective healthcare workers across the spectrum from nurses to pharmacists to doctors, I think it's great. And I do think that we as a country have a lot to offer. We're doing it on the science side. We hopefully will have some exciting scientists also come up north from the U.S. in the coming months. And I do think that this is a moment. It's not going to be forever, but it's particularly ugly down there right now. And we offer a much more stable government and society than they do at this point.
Alisa, do you have Americans in your health team? And I remember for a long time we were talking about how your healthcare team wanted to hire a nurse practitioner, and that went vacant for months.
Right. So we actually never were able to successfully find a nurse practitioner. So with the funding that we got through the Ontario government, other people also got it, and it's quite competitive to find a nurse practitioner. We did get a physician assistant who had worked at another clinic and decided to go back to her old clinic. So I was told that it was going to be a long time until we found another physician assistant because it's so competitive out there and we're competing with hospitals, and the funding that a hospital is able to pay is more than that what a clinic could pay. But what's interesting is that last week a new person arrived who is a physician assistant, and interestingly enough, she is from the States, and she just moved here. I think she has family here. And that was probably one of the motivating factors for her to arrive. And so she's from the States and she moved here and she's been working as a physician assistant in the States. And we just welcomed her to our team last week. So we were able to actually find somebody, and that person did come from the States.
Okay, well, there you go. I'd like to talk a little bit about a disturbing thing that seems at odds with our publicly funded healthcare system. So we had at least one case, and this was not here in Ontario. It was I forget if it was Manitoba or Saskatchewan, where a healthy young woman died after for-profit plasma donations. No, it must have been in Alberta. And this is something that apparently is very rare, but some people, in order to make a bit of extra cash, are making these plasma donations, like, really often, Fahad. I mean, what did you think? And who would have thought that I think this young woman was 22?
Yeah. Honestly, this story made me a bit sad, I have to say, when I read it. So the person that they interviewed for this was in Winnipeg, a postal worker. He does it weekly. It gives him an extra $100. And he says, you know, it helps with groceries. It means maybe I can take my wife out to dinner. And he jokes that, you know, my blood is paying for this dinner. And it just honestly made me sad to hear it, because we know cost of living has gone up so much, right? And the idea that people would be donating at this frequency in order to just support basic things like getting groceries was tragic, I have to say, when I read it. This is a pretty surprising thing, I would say, to me. The impact on donating plasma at this frequency. So plasma is the clear part of your blood that is not the red blood cells. It's all the fluid around it. And it contains a lot, which is incredibly important for your body. It contains the antibodies that fight infection. It contains a lot of other enzymes and electrolytes. And there's a lot in there which is critical. If you're the limit that is being allowed to give large volumes twice a week, that is a lot. And the early emerging studies around this suggest that the people who are donating in a very concrete way are depleting these things in their body, their immune system and other parts of the body, which are critical. And the more you do it, the worse it gets. And so there's this weird unregulated space where people can do it for money. Not every province allows it. We're having emerging evidence that it is causing consequence. And then we have these deaths, which are being investigated. And it does suggest to me that we probably need to look at this much more carefully and consider whether we need to more tightly regulate it or reduce frequencies. And just understand this enormous, sad underbelly of why it's occurring. It's people are donating essentially parts of their body away on a regular basis because they can't pay for things that are important for daily life. I just think that's very tragic.
Well, it is very tragic, but you would have thought, I think that the company that they were donating to is Spanish. So you'd think a European company might have some rules down, or you think that there might be some limits on how frequently you do it. I mean, if you're donating regular blood to the Red Cross, I mean, they have limits on it, Alisa.
So I'll be honest, I was quite shocked that you can donate, that you can actually give your plasma and actually receive financial compensation within Canada. And I did a little bit of deeper digging because they specifically talked about Manitoba. And in Ontario, the Canadian Blood Services, you can donate plasma at Canadian Blood Services, and that is the same as you donating blood. That is a volunteer. You do not get paid for it. But the Canadian Blood Services has partnered with that Spanish company and does offer within the province for-profit plasma donation. And it's even more terrible when I tell you that the amount that you get paid, that if you donate more frequently, that the amount that you receive is actually more. And to be honest, I was quite shocked. I did not even know that this existed. And it makes me so upset that people, in order to survive in our world these days, would have to be donating plasma, and that there's this financial incentive and a push by these companies that to donate more frequently. And I was just so disappointed to believe that this is happening here, and unfortunately that it is.
So I'm just now, I know they were looking at making it legal in Ontario. So is it, or is it just that was in Manitoba?
So it's a gray area within Ontario. So the Canadian Blood Services does not pay. You donate as if you would donate, but they've partnered with this company. So it's sort of a gray area, and it's considered to be that you're getting an honorarium for doing the donation. The European guideline is that you can only donate twice per month. But the Canadian, in here in Ontario, you do get paid more if you donate twice a week versus once a week or less frequently. So I'm just shocked, and I can't believe that we're having this conversation. I did not know that this existed.
Well,
can I just add, I mean, think about that. The Europeans' own guideline doesn't allow it. So a European company comes into Canada to exploit, you know, poor Canadians to do it twice a week. It's very sad. Like, it's very sad, this story.
Malcolm? Malcolm? Are we having trouble with your audio? You're muted, Malcolm. Okay. You're muted. Ziv, maybe give him a shout and tell him he's muted.
I should be okay.
Oh, go ahead. Are you there now? Nope.
The first point, particularly like.
Okay.
There's a desperate need for blood and plasma for cancer treatment. And there's always been that need. But there's a reason that a lot of jurisdictions do not allow off a donation, because there can be risks to people donate too much, and there can be risks to the patient. The patients they're donating to, if they're not honest about their medical conditions. So again, like the others, I think this is a very sad situation, and this needs to be tightly regulated along the lines of what's occurring in Europe.
So yes, there's a big need for this in cancer treatment. So where is it at in terms of, do you think we have as much as we need, half as much, three quarters as much from the system the way it is now?
Well, I'm not an expert in this area. I think, honestly, lately we have not had the situation where we have not been able to transfuse people who need it because of a shortage. I think we're very careful about who we transfuse. I'm talking mainly about transfusion here, but we're very careful. I think the levels of blood that we transfuse at are lower now than they used to be, because it's been found safe. You don't need to transfuse people if they're slightly lower than normal. But I think it's always an ongoing challenge to get enough blood through donations to supply the needs of the population. I mean, that's a reality, but it's been true that way. But fortunately in Canada, the system is generally run on the benevolence of all the people who step forward and donate.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that these incidences, these tragic incidences, will kind of forestall the move to, because I remember a push, you know, let people make money from this. So do you think that this will lead to, you know, taking that off the table?
Well, I think it will. I think you have to make sure this is better regulated. That's for sure. And the problem is that if people are motivated by the fact that they need money for food, they might, unless you have a good registry of when they last donated, they may not be honest about, oh, I haven't done it for a couple of weeks. So I think it's very clear that if people are going to donate, it needs to be recorded. It needs to be on some sort of universal record, so we know, you know, kind of that they're not donating too frequently. And again, I think you'd better got donating twice a week to me seems extraordinarily frequent and potentially dangerous. I think it needs to be less frequent than that.
I hadn't even, read that before Elisa mentioned it. I find that, like, totally shocking. Anything else anybody wants to say on this to wrap things up?
No, I'll just add to your question about supply, Libby, just to, you know, emphasize, this is a critically important part of our blood product supply into the health system. The products of plasma play a critical role, as Malcolm mentioned, in cancer, but we use it on my medical wards as well. Like, there's incredibly important things that come from plasma. And in fact, when you talk to Canadian Blood Services, the plasma supply will often run into shortages faster than other parts of the blood supply, especially some of the critical products like the immunoglobulins that come from it. So this is a tough problem. Like, I don't want to take away from the supply problems. I just want to say that this solution is tragic and feels pretty unacceptable without tighter regulation, but it doesn't take away from the fact that the supply of this product is very important, and it is something that is tenuous right now.
Okay. Well, a tough problem. I'm sure we will talk about that again. In the meantime, thanks so much, Dr. Elisa Naiman, Dr. Malcolm Moore, and Dr. Fahad Razak, and we will talk again soon. Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye, Wendy.
Okay, we are taking a break, and we've been talking about how the cost of living, the cost of buying food has driven some people to donate their plasma too often. Well, it's had a lot of other impacts as well. And we're going to look at that whole thing when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, this morning the Bank of Canada decided to hold interest rates steady despite signs that the economy is deteriorating, particularly when it comes to jobs. And earlier this week, we were told that the latest inflation numbers are good news because of a drop in the rate of inflation. But critics say, and we've had this conversation, that the inflation rate does not reflect the everyday experience of Canadians. And I want to get into that a little bit more. And meanwhile, a survey from Vivid Data finds that half of us, half of Canadians, are living paycheck to paycheck. So people, please let me know what your experience of all of this is. Our text line and long-distance phone line, 866-740-4740, and our local phone line, 416-360-0740. And I'm now joined by Moshe Lander, who is a senior lecturer of economics at Concordia University in Montreal, Anthony Quinn, the president of CARP, and Pat Pellegrini, president and CEO of Vivi Data. Hi, all. Welcome. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Libby.
Okay. This started with you, Anthony, and you were telling us that on Monday we were talking about the inflation rate, that is not the experience of people mostly who are trying to put food on the table, and that you've actually talked to somebody from the Bank of Canada about that.
Yeah, we had a consultation with the Bank of Canada. They'd speak to stakeholders, and CARP represents older Canadians. But our message to them was our seniors in Canada, like, don't believe your lying eyes. You walk into a grocery store and you see that cheese and milk and beef have gone through the roof over the last few years. And you're walking by those aisles now saying, I can't afford it. And for the Stats Canada and the inflation rate to come out at 1.8% in February, does that reflect the experience that Canadians are having at the grocery store? No, it does not.
And what is the problem? I think you were saying that the problem is the way the rate is calculated.
Yeah, this basket of goods that the Consumer Price Index and how they calculate inflation, it has shelter in it as 29%, but they also include mortgage rates in that. So if mortgage rates are down, then inflation is low, maybe, but that doesn't affect older Canadians because they're not typically mortgage holders. Transportation and food are two of the items, and that makes sense, but not when it comes to like durable goods. So that's an important part of the inflationary index, but Canadians who are older, they're not buying appliances and refrigerators in large numbers like they did when they were younger consumers.
I'd like to bring in Moshe Lander. So Moshe, what is in the basket and how is it weighted? Like,
It is a basket of the goods and services that the typical consumer buys, and it's something that I always highlight, which is that's an average, and none of us are average, and the basket really doesn't apply to any of us. So over a large number of Canadians, the people that say this is overweighting and those that say it's underweighting average out, It would be very similar if I were to give you an academic analogy, that if I came in and told you that the class average on a test is 75%, nobody would think that everybody in the class got 75%. But of course, the real interesting part of the story, if you want to dig into the details, is how many people got 90 or 100, how many people failed, and what's the distribution. And so what's being picked up then by the survey is that, yes, seniors are going to say, we're not average. But similarly, we could have the exact same argument that young people in their 20s are going to say, neither are we. But if you average out 20-something-year-olds with 70-something-year-olds, then it does average that this is what the typical Canadian experience. And that's why you have to really treat the data carefully, because it's merely picking up one number to represent 40 million Canadians.
And is there some kind of profile that represents the average? I mean, do they say that the average is a 40-year-old with two kids? Or, like, who is this average?
Yeah, it doesn't identify who the average person is. It just says that this is the average experience. So in theory, you could create some sort of profile, I guess, but that itself is hard. Let's say that there's two people that are in this survey. One is 20 and one is 70. We're not going to say then that the average person is 45 years old. There's nobody there that's 45. It's a person that's 20 and it's a person that's 70. If the person is 20 and has no kids, and the person is 70, has two kids, but they're fully grown with their own grandchildren, again, we're not really talking about being able to create an average profile. It's merely just saying, this is the experience of all Canadians, and let's try and average it out. You could, I guess, get to some more granular detail then, that if you only wanted to restrict it to certain demographic groups, you could create something similar. So when we talk about the consumer price index, people might be surprised to realize there's a producer's price index, there's a manufacturer's price index, and of course, there's a CPI for every province in Canada. So the ability to parse that data to only look at one group is certainly possible. And of course, it's going to tell a very different story then, because it's going to be the average of that demographic that you're looking at.
I'd like to bring in Pat. So we've seen from the posted inflation rate, good news, it's 1.8%. It's a drop, but you're finding that half of Canadians are living paycheck to paycheck. So first of all, is there a profile for that? Is that people in what demographic or what area?
No, first, you know, great to be here. And what my other guests said is spot on. I mean, we survey 75,000 Canadians exactly for that reason, because you can't have a national number here and talk about it. You need to look at, and even beyond provinces. So to answer your question, we could see that 25 to 34, I think it was in my survey, we broke it out. You can break it out any number of ways when you've got that many people. So I just made it into digestible chunks, but I completely agree with Moshe and Anthony. Those younger people are carrying a lot of non-mortgage debt, and the slightly older, 35 to 49, are carrying a mortgage. And what their decisions are different. Like in our survey, the younger group that's also carrying non-mortgage debt, credit card debt, they're talking about making decisions daily that would affect what they do. They might be putting groceries on their credit card and building up their credit card debt, which, as we know, could take many years to get out of. Whereas, mortgage holders, and many Canadians have paid off their mortgage. Those with a remaining mortgage, it's, 60% have less than 15 years. If I rank the top 10 cities, those are not the top 10 cities that have mortgage debt amounts, right? So it varies across. There's a disconnect between the biggest and most expensive cities and actually the mortgage debt that's remaining for Canadians. And those Canadians, they're looking at discretionary choices, like, is it time to buy a new car or do I hold off for a couple of years? Do I not have a vacation? It's very different decision making, but yeah, you see it in the data when we do summarize it. 49% say they're living paycheck to paycheck. That's what Canadians feel. 58% say they have less disposable income than before.
And what about Pat? Before we move on, older people who are on fixed incomes, do they also feel that they're living from paycheck to paycheck?
Yeah, no, that the number that I gave you does include everyone. If we broke it out, it would be a similar, little bit higher percentage. It hasn't changed much from last year either, by the way. These numbers were around last year. They're very similar. We did compare that. So yes, it is consistent across age groups. Typically, we do break things down. I'm in the world of consumer and media where we break things down into very precise segments, consistent with what your guests have said, because Canadians are all different. There's a lot of different groups there, but overall, they are feeling the pain here.
No, we hear, so Pat has the large numbers, but we have the anecdotal stories from our members, CARP members, seniors across Canada, who really are experiencing that paycheck to paycheck. And as inflation is hitting their daily lives, the programs that they have in place, their CPP, their old age security, maybe a little bit of money coming out of savings or a pension, that is not keeping up with the inflation. And CARP has argued for a seniors price index so that when they are indexing these government programs, they should be actually reflective of the inflation they're experiencing, not this phantom number of 1.8%, which really doesn't affect or influence their experience on the ground.
And do you think that the basket should be changed or just to have this separate seniors price index?
We had asked Justin Trudeau when he was coming into government to introduce the seniors price index, and he nodded his head and said he would do that. He did sort of hedge on that increase and gave an OAS increase to those 75 plus. Didn't increase it for the 65 to 74 year olds. And that was his way of helping Canadian seniors deal with inflation. It certainly, if you're 68 years old, you're experiencing inflation the same way that a 76 year old is. And that's been our argument, that the increase to OAS should be for every retiree.
Moshe, I mean, do you think that adjusting the basket would be a good solution, or do we need a separate price index for seniors or, again, you know, for young people?
Yeah, I don't think it's a problem to have a separate index for seniors, but that's the way the negotiations go. So in people that are currently working, you would negotiate with your employer where the employer says, I'm going to give you a 1.8% raise. And the employee is going to say, wait a second, that basket doesn't reflect me, or it doesn't reflect my members if you're unionized. This is the basket of the people that we represent, and therefore we deserve a 4% raise. And that's how negotiations work. So seniors groups can certainly construct their own basket. It's not something that they require the government to do. And they say that based on our members, based on our polling, this is what we feel is indicative of what we're experiencing. And therefore, we feel the government program should be indexed to this number. Now, of course, the government can push back and say, we're not going to do it, or we're not going to be able to pay for it. If we're going to pay for it, we're going to have to raise taxes or cut spending elsewhere. And that's how politics goes. And that's how lobbying goes. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with creating that basket to merely highlight the differences that might exist within the various demographics of society. But I think the other thing to consider too is that, say, for 18 months post-COVID, the Bank of Canada has kept inflation between 1 and 3% per year. Again, that's on average. I think where people are really noticing that it's become a problem is that the better part of the last 30 years, incomes have not kept pace with that. And of course, that's going to be true with seniors, because at best, they're going to be able to negotiate a cost of living adjustment that goes to the average Canadian and not necessarily their particular demographic. But I think the reason why most Canadians, you cited 50%, are saying we can't make ends meet, it's not because inflation is measured incorrectly or because inflation is too high. It's because incomes are not capable of rising fast enough. And that's a much bigger issue that we can discuss on a different show at a different time. But that's really where the solution's going to come from. It's not better measurement of inflation or more granular detail. It's how do we unleash this productivity puzzle that's been hampering Canada for 30 years. It predates Trudeau. It predates Harper. It goes back to the 1980s even. It's just we didn't notice it then because it was so subtle at the time, but accumulated over a generation, it's become a real issue now.
Okay, I'm going to take a call from Helen in Toronto. Hi, Helen.
Hi, Libby. Could it be that the way we were raised, because our parents had to struggle for everything, we were raised in a way that is different than, I tried to raise my kids the same way, it didn't help, but we were raised not to buy something until we could pay for it. I opened a separate bank account to save up for a car, and I paid for it when I bought it. I've tried to do that with my kids. It just doesn't seem to work. But I think the mindset now is, I need it, I want it, I'm getting it. Instead of, you may need it, or you may want it, but you can't get it because you don't have the money ready.
I'm going to let Anthony take that one.
That was certainly a lesson handed down by the sort of the wartime generation to their boomer children. But I think maybe Moshe can explain this better than I, but having credit and availability of credit is actually great for the economy. It stimulates the economy and allows people to pay off things in time, and has been, I think, a boon for North American society. Maybe defer to the expert.
I completely agree. Credit is essential. Now, I am a Gen Xer. I'm the child of a boomer, and I was raised with the exact same thought process of don't buy something unless you have the cash to pay for it.
I don't know that boomers actually follow that. Our parents did. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I think that the advantage of credit is that it allows you to what we would call in economics smooth consumption. So if all you do is get paid every 2 weeks, and let's say you still get paid in cash, you have to be extremely good at budgeting to be able to make that last. But of course, the things like buying a car, buying appliances, buying a house is going to be impossible if you only pay when you have cash. Especially these days, you're going to be in your 50s before you could accumulate enough cash to be able to make the down payment, let alone outright buy the house. Credit is essential. The thing that I would advise younger people today, and it's something I say to my own kids, whether they listen or not, time will tell, is just because the bank offers you credit doesn't mean that you have to take it. And I think that might be the problem that people have fallen into, that when the bank says, look, you qualify for X amount, that doesn't mean that you should take X amount or that you should fully utilize the X amount. It's merely that it's there if you need it, when you need it, but you don't have to use it. That also needs a little bit of self-restraint. And so like your caller was saying, if you're not going to buy something unless you have the cash, the modern equivalent is just because it's there does not mean that you have to use it now. And that's my constrain a little bit your living today, but it allow you for an emergency tomorrow, or it allow you for some flexibility tomorrow as well, especially in an economy where jobs are not guaranteed.
Well, yeah, and I remember back in the day where we would take all the credit that the bank offered us, not use it, because the thought was, well, gee, if we ever get into a position where we really need it, we won't qualify. So, but again, there are even ramifications to that, because the credit you have access to affects your credit rating. I'm going to give you the last word, Pat.
Yeah, a great conversation. I totally agree that it's wages that are causing issues with younger people who want some of the same things that we were able to get when we were a little bit younger. But what I can also see from my data, happy, Anthony, to share cuts of the data with different age groups with you anytime, but we're here to serve. And what we're seeing is people using their credit cards. So they have accepted a certain amount of credit and they are using that for day-to-day decisions. And what I worry about is some of these people will take 10 years to pay them off.
Bad idea.
And we've seen more and more Canadians retiring with debt. That didn't used to be the case, because they've sort of financed their lives a little longer using their home equity and other resources that they had.
Okay. Again, we are going to have to talk about this more, but in the meantime, thanks so much. Anthony Quinn, Pat Pellegrini, and Moshe Lander, bye-bye.
Thanks, Libby. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, well, when we come back, we're going to talk about something that has seen a great deal of inflation, and we've talked about it a lot, and that is tipping. And there is another survey on tipping, and I think the latest backlash against it may be in effect. We will talk about that when we come back, and I bet people want to have their say. So let me give the text line and the numbers out again. Tell us about all the requests for tips, 866-744-740. That's the text line, the long-distance phone line, and 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866. I just said that. It's like an automatic thing. We'll talk about tipping when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to 1. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, it seems that a new backlash is building against the never-ending requests for tips on everything. And it's gotten to the point where two-thirds of respondents to the latest survey on this think tips should be abolished altogether. I don't agree with that, but 93% say it's gotten out of hand. And let me tell you about an experience I had yesterday. I was running late. I did not have time for lunch. I ran into a Starbucks to get a snack between one thing to the next. And I got to the counter. I had to pick up my own snack. It was extremely expensive for what it was. And the only thing that the person working there handed me was the machine to pay. And normally I would have a little bit of compunction, the person handing me the machine probably making minimum wage. But I thought, well, like, what is this? I even picked this thing up myself and I kind of screwed up my courage and I hit no tip because there was a setting for quite a big tip on this. And the question is, why should the customer who's already paying a big price for this be subsidizing the wages? So I did hit no tip. And the only thing I'll say about it is that there was a time where if you didn't want to leave a tip, you'd have to go through three more steps on the machine this time. And I've noticed lately it's there. So people, tell me what you think about that. 866-740-4740 or 416-360-0740. And I don't know, would you give a tip where the only thing that the only service that you received from somebody working in a place was handing you the machine? Right now, let's go to Sylvain Charlebois, who is the professor and senior director of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University. Hi, Sylvain.
Hi.
So is there a backlash against this building again?
I guess so. I mean, a lot of people are annoyed by tip creep, as we call it. Became a victim of tip creep. You actually went to Starbucks and you weren't expecting to be asked for a tip, but you were. And I think it does annoy a lot of people. And so that's one piece of what's happening with tipping. Because when you think about the food industry has several sectors. You have QSR, quick service, you have casual dining, fine dining. And tipping actually serves a different purpose for each and every sector. But I would say mostly a lot of people are wondering or questioning the practice itself in terms of where the money is going. We've heard of scandals, for example, of the fact that some money didn't go directly to employees. But the other issue, of course, is wages. A lot of people think that tipping is part of this wage subsidy program that many restaurant operators are running. And so there's lots of questions around the practice itself these days.
Yeah, I mean, it is a wage subsidy. And I remember back when there were a few restaurants, these are full service restaurants that said, we are abolishing tipping, we're adding whatever 18% onto the bill and the money is going to our servers, which is good to know. And even at a Starbucks, you know, if a barista there actually makes me one of these complicated coffees, I don't mind giving them a tip. But if all they give me is the machine, that's something else.
Absolutely. Now, a lot of people may want tipping to disappear, but tipping will still exist. I mean, at the end of the day, you either include tipping in the price on menus, or you basically ask people to pay for tipping afterwards. The challenge, of course, is if you have one establishment in Toronto, for example, moving away from tipping and including tipping in price, you make that restaurant less competitive and people will go somewhere else. The other issue, and I've actually spoken to some chefs and operators in Toronto that have actually done that, they've lost their best servers because good servers actually tend to be tipped more. And And so that's why I think there's a role for policy here to get involved, because if you only have a handful of restaurants doing this, chances are the policy for that restaurant will fail. And that's why I think it'd be important now to have a broader debate about the tipping culture that we have in Canada. Quebec has decided to clarify rules, but they're still going ahead with tipping in particular. It's just, for example, you can't tip on taxes, for example. There are some clarity in terms of how you give the machine to the person. You have to move away. So if someone doesn't want to give a tip, there you're not embarrassed by it, or you're not. It doesn't create an awkward situation.
That's interesting. I did not know about that, and who's going to enforce that?
Well, I mean, I know that the industry, it's a blind spot for the industry, because it's just, how do you tackle an issue as complicated as this? And I do think that there's a role to play by the provincial government. So in your case, obviously, it would be Queen's Park, to actually lead the way in terms of having a conversation, because the results of the HR Block survey were surprising. We surveyed Canadians 2 years ago about this issue, and only a quarter of Canadians wanted tipping to disappear. And so now we're at 2/3 now. That's a high number. I'm not sure I believe in results, but I do think that the debate is actually growing.
Okay, yeah, I'm just going to read a very quick text. We're almost out of time. We'll have to talk about this again. From Barty in North York, I'm not against tipping based on service. What frustrates me most is that grocery delivery organizations expect you to tip before the shopping and delivery.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not
managing
a tip,
expectations.
It's a surcharge.
Well, those are the subtle things that are annoying a lot of people. You know, you have to make sure that tipping has a purpose, and it allows the person to evaluate someone's performance. Not before, certainly, and in a equitable manner. So that those are the kinds of things that I suspect policy could address eventually.
Okay, well, interesting thought. Again, we'll talk about it again, people. Free for All Friday, not far from here. Thank you so much, Sylvain Charlebois, and I'm sure we'll talk about this again. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, that is all the time we have for Fight Back for today. Follow us on YouTube. Follow us on Instagram. I'm Libby Znaimer. I'll be back here tomorrow, and we'll talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.